morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm three sips into my coffee, so give me a break.
Mine is still too hot to drink. I should probably take the cover off. That might cool it down just a tad.
Cover off? Were you out getting coffee this morning?
No, but I try to only have one cup while we're recording, and so I put it in one of those Yeti mugs to keep it hot, but sometimes that means I could never actually get to it, because thermodynamics, you know all that stuff.
Yeah, science.
Let's talk science today.
Ooh, nice.
I scared you the other day by texting you some big words that you're not used to hearing out of me.
Scared? I was more excited.
I was reading, and I sent James a note and said, hey, how about we talk about orthonasal and retronasal sensation when you're drinking beer? And he wrote back and said, who dis?
More or less, yes.
Yeah. So I read something and got excited.
Well, you had to text me a picture of the book that you were reading just to prove that, you know, this isn't somebody wasn't feeding you words off screen.
Right. I didn't I didn't hear this on someone else's podcast and say, ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was reading.
Yeah. Yes, aroma science. Mm-hmm. You bet.
Sometimes we read, you know, when my streaming services all go down and I have nothing to stare at, I'll read a book.
Analog internet, is that what it is? Mm-hmm. Analog internet, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, orthonasal, retronasal sensory experiences.
Yay.
And for the six of you that are still listening, we're going to have a stimulating conversation.
Stimulating. Oh, I see what you did there. And those six who are listening are now down to three. Mm-hmm. Oh, bad. So orthonasal and retronasal. And the idea here, orthonasal are stimuli coming when you sniff in, and retronasal is the sensation you get when you're breathing out of your nose and what the sensations you get that way.
Right. Ortho, front, coming in through your nose holes, and retro, coming up the back of your nasal cavity from your throat, usually upon swallowing, and stimulating those nerve endings. In your olfactory region from the backside.
Mm-hmm. Now it's the same. It's the same nerve endings. It's hitting the same place. Mm-hmm. It's just going about it a different way. And of course, through swallowing and through chewing and all that, things change. Things are released, which makes a profound difference. We're also used to sniffing things through the front. That's what we're more accustomed to, and that's more of, I think, a conscious activity, whereas the retronasal sensations are more of a passive or a subconscious activity at times.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Unless you're a sniffing expert, someone like you who takes more care when that's going on to pay attention.
Well, you're being conscious about it. There's, I think, three aspects here. There's the physiology that's going on, the physical chemistry of the compounds, whether that's vapor that you're inhaling or it's aroma compounds dissolved in liquid, like beer when you're drinking. Mm-hmm. And then there's the psychological aspect, which I find the most interesting, because the psychological aspect can create things that are absolutely not there. Mm-hmm. And they will cause confusion on your palate if you can't name them, right? If you don't know already what it is, you have such a much harder time differentiating what it is than if you already, somebody told you what it is. And that just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. A big part of it is language, that there are so many more sensations of smell than there are words to describe them. And the same with taste. We just don't have the ability to put into words. And that's why, and you've heard us talk about this before, you hear descriptors like meaty and floral. And that descriptors that don't necessarily make a lot of sense. You know, what does green? Green is a descriptor. What does green smell like? Well, it smells like grass. And like, how did green become a descriptor? It's because we don't have the words.
Or people don't understand what it is of those aspects that they say, well, it smells green. It's like, what does green mean? Well, it smells like a lush forest. Okay, that's not green. Mm-hmm. That's probably geosmin, which is one of those aromas that comes, like people say, oh, I love that. It smells like a forest path after a gentle rainstorm kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, that's geosmin. That's a single chemical. Get over yourself. It's not that poetic. but, you know, you can't say, oh, my God, this hop is fantastic. Did you get the geosmin is just, you know, stimulating. It's saying it's green or lush. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. there's that vocabulary aspect to it that, you know, drives me nuts. But the thing that I just, and we'll talk about this, I think, maybe towards the end of the episode, but this concept of if you know what it is, if you can identify, if you have a word for it, then your likelihood of correctly identifying that aroma compound or what it's associated with is dramatically, dramatically higher, statistically significantly higher than if you're giving something unknown to sniff, you know, an unknown sample.
Yep.
And be like, how do I, now I can't put a word, I can't identify this thing as tomato. Now I have to use something different, a different way to describe things instead of a, you know, single identifier. Now you have to use descriptors to do it. And that's where people seem to fall apart.
Sure.
In hop and beer sensory.
Yeah, it's confusing, and it's confusing in your own brain. And of course, then you take it to the marketing and sales aspect, and you're trying to describe a hop to brewers. You know, they're piney, they're resinous. You see the same words over and over again. And I think we're at the point now, even when you see advertisements in the New Brewer, for example, for new varieties and things like that, you see the same descriptors over and over again, but it's more piney than this and less resinous than this.
Right, right.
We're kind of stuck using those same dozen terms because that's all people know.
Yep. So you've taken a trying to figure out what the term for that is. I knew I was going to forget it if I didn't write it down.
And you didn't write it down.
Of course I didn't. Hold on a second. Let me find it. Profiling strategy. You're trying to build a profile with descriptive words that you don't necessarily have individual identifiers for. Mm-hmm. As opposed to something that's already you have a cognitive representation of, mm-hmm. like banana. Describe a banana without using the word banana. And we talked about this with colors, too. It's like, describe the color blue without using blue. Or referencing other colors. How do you do that?
I don't know. I don't know. It's conceptually, it's the kind of thing that makes your brain hurt if you think about it for more than 3 seconds.
Right. Right. So you've got this idea of categorical, mm-hmm. you know, descriptors like banana or tomato or laundry detergent, right? We know what laundry detergent is, a whole mix of other aromas that are in there, other fragrances, right? But in general, yeah, there's differences from brand to brand, right? But in general, people can identify, ooh, laundry detergent. What is that, right? It's a whole mix of other compounds. Well, the same thing goes with like a banana. It's a whole host of other compounds in there. So you don't have to be a perfumer to pick apart the individual compounds to really appreciate what these are in like hops. It's the combination of these compounds that make the whole, that make something a cascade or a mosaic or a glacier. And that's okay, right? It's not like, I think our hop growers and beer tasters get really bent out of shape because they think that they should be able to dissect these hop compounds as like a measure of their beer and hop prowess. And that's not the case.
Sure. Sure, you know, how much linalool am I tasting?
Right, yeah. Does it matter? No, not usually. Mm-hmm. But if you want to understand the science of it, and when you start getting down to blending things, and maybe the brewer needs to understand that a little bit more if they want to bring out a nuance here or there. But, you know, the vast majority of folks don't care. It is a descriptor of that experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, this beer tastes like grapefruit. Yes, it does. It does. That's the 87 pounds of Citra.
Yeah. You mean rotten grapefruit?
Yes, rotten. Yes, I meant rotten grapefruit.
Yeah. Maybe with a dead skunk mixed in there somewhere.
Ooh, that mm-hmm. takes on a whole new level, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm just describing it. I'm profiling.
Nice. Isn't that more cognitive because you've experienced it?
It is. Now it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I can say, oh my God, that dead skunk smells like Citra. Okay. Let's talk science.
Yay.
First. Let's talk chemistry.
Okay.
So you described orthonasal versus retronasal. So in through the front or up through the back. And why do these things differ? You're like, it's my nose, dude. What my nose smells. You know, it shouldn't really matter because you also mentioned that it's the same receptors. Mm-hmm. That's true. But it's the method of delivery that matters. So when you inhale through your nose, well, in both cases, whatever the aroma compound is, it has to be volatilized in order for it to be perceived by your olfactory receptors in the back of your nasal cavity. So that means it's got to be in the air. And as we've talked loads of times about how aroma compounds volatilize, heat. Heat is usually the easiest thing for people to understand. If you heat something up, it gets smellier, or you smell it more, right? That's why those room air diffusers plug into an outlet, because they need heat in order to volatilize that stuff. So when you're inhaling through your nose, it's whatever, you know, the compounds that are going to go into your nose have to first be volatilized into the air, and they do that based on the heat of whatever that object is that's giving off those aroma compounds. So hops, right? Mm-hmm. If you've just got a table or a handful of hops, it's going to be mostly at ambient and a little bit of heat from your hand. So let's just say for shits and giggles that that's 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Compare that to those same hop compounds that are present in beer, and you put it in your mouth and it hits your palate and you swish it around because you're doing an actual tasting, that liquid, even though it came out of the tap cold, hopefully, it's going to heat up really quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's going to change the heat, the volatilization of those compounds. And you're going to experience something different.
And you know, we talk about heat, but it doesn't necessarily mean hot. I mean, things volatilize at room temperature.
Yep.
You're getting aroma off of beer and many other things at room temperature. So you don't go putting your beer on the stove.
No, please don't do that. No. Well, you could if you would like a different retronasal experience. If you wanted to do a controlled study to see what your retronasal olfactory sensory system will tell you, of a hop that's cold at room temperature and hot, I think you will find some very interesting things.
Yeah, and I would make the argument that you use the word controlled experiment, and anyone outside of brewing who's putting a beer on the stove, there's no control going on there whatsoever. Just don't do
that. Fair enough. I stand corrected. You are absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So this is a challenge, a particularly difficult challenge. This retro versus ortho is challenging for hop growers and hop sensory geeks like me, particularly because what you smell in that hop and what comes through in the beer can be and usually is dramatically different. So not only do you have to have a contextual basis for those varieties to know what they already smell like, because I know what a Cascade smells like. I don't have to pick it apart. Mm-hmm. But then I go, and so I could rub those Cascade, I can huff those hops orthonasally through the front. I can pick up on these compounds and say, this is what a Cascade smells like. Then I can have a pale ale brewed with Cascade. Let's say it's a smash beer, and it's only Cascade. Not all of those compounds, depending on how they were brewed, are going to come through in that beer. Because you're going to flash off, it depends on how the brewer used it, how it was dry hopped, all that kind of stuff. So now my experience with that Cascade in beer is a new experience. They're related, but they're not the same. Mm-hmm. So now I have to build that library in my brain of what does that beer with Cascade taste like? And what is the retronasal experience? And correlate the two in my own mind. That takes a ton of work and is why I have been drunk most of my life, I think.
All in the name of science.
All in the name of science. So I wanted to highlight this because there's so many of our listeners and especially our hypnologists that are super frustrated by this. They're like, I got to take some classes. I got to learn how to do this. It takes experience. It's mm-hmm. not like you're going to go through one class and you're going to get it.
Yeah.
It's just not going to, it's not going to be that way. This is an art that one has to study. It's not, there's science to it, but it's mostly experiential, right? So you've got to build your own repertoire. And frankly, some people just can't do it because they don't, their olfactory system is not maybe as refined or can pick out as many of those details as others. You may be aroma blind to some of these compounds.
Yeah. And the actual biology of it, the nerves and whatnot, in your nasal passages, there are folks that have, I think 20% of the population has a finely attuned sense of smell and taste, mm-hmm. and I imagine you're in that group. Another 20% has a very, very poorly attuned sense of smell and taste, and the other 60% somewhere in between.
Yeah, so I buy that.
Yeah, you could be an absolute lover of beer and different styles and whatnot, and be in that bottom 20% where you'll never really have those distinguishing ability. Doesn't mean you don't try. Doesn't mean you don't mess around with it. You'll still have plenty of things that you can understand about what's different about the beers, but you may never get to that point of this needs a little more linalool in it.
Yeah, you need to practice. Believe it or not, I know this is going to shock a lot of you. Most brewers can't do this either.
Oh, sure.
And so that's why they say things like, I need more linalool. And my question is, why? Right, there's a brewery in Wisconsin, a Pearl Street Brewery, and they had a beer called linalool. Because it was, yeah, I think they still have it, but they were using this found variety from Wisconsin called Northern Discovery that, oh, it had so much more linalool than everything else, and this is going to be the next big thing. No, it didn't. Total bullshit. But anyway, it sold. It sold like crazy. But where did the linalool come from? Like Mosaic. I think it was one of those other hops. I don't remember which one it was. It wasn't from that Northern Discovery. But anyway, you know, that's a whole marketing episode. But the concept is, why do you think that you need more linalool? And why is it that one compound? Why? Well, you know, that's what everybody's looking for. Who is this everybody? And who is the everybody who produced the information that says everybody needs this?
Someone who's selling linalool.
I don't get it, right? And it's like, well, linalool is responsible for the hop intensity. No, it's not. Study after study has shown that. Stop it. You know, here's your stupid ticket. Leave me alone.
Your ticket? What?
Yeah. I want to like a speeding ticket book that at the top says stupid ticket.
Oh, I like
that. And every time somebody's being stupid, I write them a ticket. And I get to fine them.
And that's the next podcast. The stupid ticket stupid with James ticket. And Greg. Yeah.
Maybe we could... From going forward, we could say, I had to issue a citation today.
I think
somebody's being stupid.
I don't think we've added a new piece of our lore here since Kevin joined the cast.
Oh, right. So. That's true. Yep. Gotta issue a citation.
Mm-hmm.
I wanna see that on the Discord.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Issue a citation. Yep.
So we got a little off here. You started to talk about temperature and why orthonasal, you know, why would orthonasal and retronasal be different? So let's jump back about 5 minutes because to your point, you start talking about temperature. So of course when things go in your mouth, they get warmer.
How about that?
It's not that kind of podcast, folks. When things go in your mouth, they get warmer. You've also got enzymes. You're breaking things down, and it releases other stuff. So what's coming back up and through retronasally can be at times substantially different than what comes in from the glass from the outside.
I would say almost all the time. I haven't done this, obviously, in quite some time. But like in Madison, sometimes I would be there's like a bartender's guild. Formal and informal times, association of servers, bartenders, and whatnot. And I would give them talks from time to time. And one of my favorite topics to discuss is temperature. And what are your freezers? What are your coolers set at? Freezers. Better not be a freezer. What are your coolers set at? What are your tap lines chilled to? And is that appropriate for every beer that you're serving? Well, you can't have a different temperature for every, you know, beer type that you're putting out. But I would argue, and I have at times, of course, you know me. That
we all do.
don't we? That these high-end beer bars are the ones that should be doing this because they tout themselves as, oh, you're going to have the best beer experience. We've got all the right glassware and we've got all these fancy, you know, taps and we hand pump stuff and blah, blah, blah. But everything comes out the same effing temperature. And it drives me insane because it shouldn't. For instance, the beer I would typically use for this experiment, and I did this with the Siebel class when they came to the hop farm 1 year. Founders All Day IPA, which I loathe, as you can imagine.
Okay.
But it's super popular. And I chose that because it's very sulfury, easily recognizable by most of the brewers and that come to Siebel. Anyway, so I took that beer and I told them, we're doing basically a taste test of hops and trying to dissect the components, and you guys tell me what hops you think are in here. And it was a simple experiment. They're like, oh, yeah, no problem. Ha-ha. So I took one beer, Founders All Day IPA, and served it at 4 different temperatures, 5 degrees apart. 5 degrees Fahrenheit difference. And they all, every single one of them, 40 some of them, every single one of them, they all guessed different. That they're like, oh, this is this, and this is that, and they must have brewed it like this, and blah, 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 blah. And then I showed them, like, this is the same beer served at 5 different temperatures. And you just described 5 totally different sensory experiences from the same beer.
They had to feel a little bit of bait and switch, but hopefully they felt they learned something from that.
Well, and they're just like, some of them were pissed.
Sure.
Because I totally nailed them. But others were just, you could see the light bulbs, right? And just like, holy crap, this is important. Of course it's important. But it's like you do all of this work to produce a sensory experience and something that's pleasurable. It's like last mile delivery, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you get it into your taps, you get it into your kegs, you get it into packaging. How is it being served? And there's a reason, I think, why I'll go to a pub and I'll see people, you know, they'll get these giant skunky-ass beers and they're talking with their friends, they drink half of it, and then they leave it sit. It's because it warmed up. And as it warms up, those compounds become way more volatile. And now, but they're putting it up to their face to take a drink, and when they open, just by the act of opening your mouth, air goes in through the front of your nose. And now you've got this much warmer liquid that has much more, there's a higher degree of volatiles in the headspace of the glass as the glass is emptying and warming up. That rushes in through your nose and totally changes your perception of what your drinking experience is going to be.
Yeah.
And it's too much. Or it changes enough that you're just like, yeah, I don't want this anymore. And it's all because of temperature.
Now, of course, there's serving temperature, but if you nurse a beer for half an hour, temperature's going to change. Mm-hmm. If you sit outside on the porch versus inside, the temperature is going to change more quickly. So there are so many outside factors you can't control. But to your point, serve it the right way. I'm trying to preempt Kevin here.
But one of the reasons I think that the American Light Lager is so popular and is the macro beer style of choice is because it changes relatively little in its aroma profile as it warms up compared to craft beers. That allows people to nurse it and sit around and have a good time and do, and not really experience a whole lot of sensory perceptions. Now, when it gets really warm, like if it's 80 degrees, 85 degrees outside and it warms up to 85 degrees plus, you're just like, yeah, I don't want this anymore.
Yeah, but you'd be like that with a glass of lemonade too. So
Correct. But that's an example of how temperature impacts aroma. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens when you're drinking a beer. So let's say that beer is served at the proper temperature. You put it in your mouth. Compared to like it sniffing it before you drink it, you can swirl it around and you can sniff it. All you're going to get orthonasally is whatever can volatilize at the temperature at which that beer was served. Mm-hmm. That's it. And for many of these compounds, that's going to be relatively little. Anything that was super duper sensitive for flash off was lost during the boil and the brewing process. So the stuff that's left is going to be relatively stable at those colder temperatures, serving temperatures. So you're going to get relatively little, even if you swish it around and try to agitate it to get some volatilization going. Carbonation has something, a place to play in this too. We'll talk about that in a second. You're going to smell one thing. You're going to put it in your mouth. You're going to swish it around. Sometimes you slurp air through it to kind of oxygenate it, or basically you're trying to get those compounds to volatilize even more as they warm up. You're adding energy to the system. You're making those molecules more active. They're bouncing around more, and they're flashing out of liquid into vapor available to go up your nose. So you're turning the dial up on the sensory experience, and you're also introducing new compounds that weren't volatile in the glass before. That's how that works. And that's why they're so different. Hmm. They usually are so different, I should say.
And you know, as I mentioned at the very beginning, for so many of us, and myself included, if I'm not thinking about it, that's a passive activity, the retronasal side of it. Whereas I'm so likely to take a sniff of my beer before I drink it because it's just kind of habit more than anything else. And in that book I was reading when I got all into this, one of the things he mentions is that, as you said, this is not something that in a day you figure out how to taste things and how to smell things and tell things apart. But he said one day you'll find yourself swirling a glass of water and drinking it the way you would, you know, in a thinking way, drink a beer. And then you'll realize you're a taster. When you just start thinking about every sensory experience this way, whenever you put something near your face.
Yep. Agreed. And I do it with coffee. I do it with tea. I do it with, you name it. You were talking before we went live here, we were talking about whiskey. And I do it with that too. It's because I'm intrigued by all of these flavor and aroma compounds. And unfortunately, those of us who are tasters and who are energized by these activities have been stigmatized as some sort of erudite, blue blood, pinky pointing drinker, right?
Mm-hmm. Pompous.
It doesn't have to be that way. You know, that's the John, right? We don't want to be that way. It's those people. You can be one of those people that enjoys doing that, and you can enjoy talking to others that also enjoy doing that. But it's like anything else that you are engaged in and that's what you're all about, nobody else gives a shit.
Oh, sure. You can still enjoy drinking without being hypercritical of all of it when you're tasting. I mean, look,
can. Everybody knows now that I am a pompous asshole. Well, so
they've all heard my 10-part series on why you don't bring James to a brewery.
Right, right.
Yeah, everyone knows this. But you, hopefully, you can still, and I think that's the fear and the danger of it is that if I know too much about this, do I cease enjoying it? Does it now become the, I mean, you talk all the time about the fact that there's really not a lot out there you like anymore. Well, damn, is that really the industry going backwards, or is it just the fact that you know so much about it and your needs now are so specific that there's no, that you've learned yourself out of enjoying the process?
There's a component of that, I will agree. Mm-hmm. James, can't you just shut up, turn your brain off, and enjoy a beer? Yes, I can. But when I do that, I want to make sure it's a beer that I know I'm going to enjoy. I don't have to be super critical of everything that I'm tasting. It's like you can turn that on and turn it off. It has changed how I approach things. I mean, you hear me talk about it all the time. And certainly, I mean, you called me out a couple of months ago. Somebody had a hazy, and I posted something about the only hazy that's worth my time was from the vintage, and you're like, I call bullshit on that. That's home court advantage or whatever you called it.
Homer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Homer pick.
But you know what? I've had, you don't like hazies and you don't try them anyway. I'm like, no, I try everything. But this one in particular with Sabro hops in it was fantastic. And the only one really that I thought was worth my time. Am I going to go out and have other hazies in order to find another one I like? No, because I don't typically enjoy them. So why would I do that?
Yep. Yeah.
So I just don't. So that's my diatribe there.
It's fair.
Anyway.
That is fair.
So we talked about ortho versus retro and why temperature and the act of, you know, getting the liquid in your mouth changes that experience, even though it's touching the same olfactory receptors. We didn't talk about carbonation and the importance that carbonation plays in bringing these aroma compounds to your sensory cells. And a lot of it has to do with, well, it's a gas dissolved in liquid. And some of these compounds they don't like to be in liquid. Right? They don't like to be in an aqueous, a water-based solution. They want to be in an oil-based solution. And CO2 is a great solvent. You've heard us talk about it in our hop extract episodes. It's a great solvent for those compounds that don't want to be in water. And so they will preferentially dissolve, quote-unquote, into the CO2. So as that CO2 is coming out of system, you know, going from a dissolved gas into an evolved gas, you're coming out of liquid, it's pulling those compounds with it. Mm-hmm. And as you put it in your mouth and it heats up, it fizzes. And all of those, or not all of those, a lot of those compounds are being carried along with that and, you know, popping. So it's the act of bringing it out of solution that's giving you that sensory experience. You'll get the same thing when you swirl your pint glass with your beer in it and you've got, you know, foam forming and you've got CO2 evolving. It's bringing those compounds up out of solution and helping to get them to pop into the air. Temperature has a big impact on the rate of CO2 evolution out of that beer. So a warmer beer is going to evolve gas faster. So that kind of is another compounding factor when we talk about temperature. It's also temperature and carbonation that's in that liquid. Compare that with a flat beer. You drink it, you're like, it's just, it tastes flat. That's how we describe it. Flat in that, yeah, it's not sparkly, but it's also just kind of dull now.
You know, that's very interesting because, yeah, I mean, a flat beer, my initial thought there was, well, if I'm tasting a beer and it's flat, I'm giving it back or I'm pouring it out because, okay, there's something wrong with this. Even though there's nothing wrong with it, it's just, it doesn't have that full set of sensory components that I would be expecting. But I will say that there are times, and everyone knows me, I'm a porter dork. If I have something in particular in the dark variety, which is more carbonated than I feel it should be, that's a complete turnoff from a sensory perspective for me.
In my experience, it's because that extra prickliness that you get from all of the carbonation is destroying the mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. And for those darker beers, you're usually looking for a smoother, heavier mouthfeel. And because that mouthfeel is counteracting the astringency from all those dark malts. And I think when you get all the CO2 in there and it makes it more prickly, it imbalances the texture more than the flavor, the aroma.
Yep.
That's just me.
I think there's something to be said for that. Absolutely.
What do you want to talk about now?
I love this article that the two of us were reading, this research paper, and I just want to point out the way in which they were looking at orthonasal and retronasal and the way they experimented on people, because it's fun to experiment on people. I feel like
Can we post this on Patreon?
We can put it on the website flat out. We have that resource.
Oh yeah. Let's put it on there. Yeah. It's a really good paper.
It is. So this will
Those of you who want to experience good science and scientific method, this is good. It's thick. I'm not gonna lie to you. Mm-hmm. If you don't speak science-ese, you might have issues with it. But look at the graphs. It says everything.
Look at the pictures are good.
Yeah, just focus on the pictures.
But even they are in grayscale. They're not in color, which is unfortunate. You know,
well, why because can't they... science manuals.
Yeah,
you know, but scientists don't have money to publish.
At least the links to the the references are in color, but that's mm-hmm. but yeah, can't even put the pretty graphs in color. So I love this. This paper, it's not long. It's 7 pages, and I think the last page and a half are footnotes, so it's okay, or references. But they looked at it in three different ways, actually three by four different ways, looked at it in 12 different ways. They said, okay, let's try and understand if folks can identify an aroma, orthonasal versus retronasal. And they took three different types of aromas. First, they went with some standards, strawberry and banana, grape, things that people know.
The contextual aromas.
Yes, for familiars, they call them.
When you smell banana, you know it's a banana. Mm-hmm. So it has that context. Yeah. Right.
Banana, grape, orange, and raspberry. Then they took another group and they tested with four aromas that you're not used to. And I mean, I don't know most of these words. I think they're fake. Did they make these words up to mask
things?
No,
they are real. They're real. And
so,
in fairness, I knew every
word. I figured you would. So yes, these were real words. You got me. Kinau, longan, pau pau, and prunus. So things that
pau pau
pau pau pau. Things that most folks would not know. Pau pau
pau pau
pau pau.
Pow pow.
Pow pow. I don't know what I'm reading here. Come on. I think I can probably read the next set properly. And those were four different types of strawberry. Strawberry A, B, C, and D. Did I say strawberry correctly? Did I get that one?
You did. You got it. Okay. Well done.
Asshole. Okay. So think about that for a second. You're familiar? Sure. I mean, you're all going, if I can't tell banana versus orange, just shoot me now. You know, okay, fair enough. The unfamiliar ones, four completely new aroma sensations that you've never had before. On the one hand, depending on what kind of a nose you've got, it might be, oh my God, these are four completely different things, no question. And this one is like this, and this one is like that. But then the four strawberries, very subtle differences potentially between four different kinds of strawberry. I don't know. I thought it was very interesting the way they did this. And then for each one, they gave you a test sample and said, here's, and they told you what it was. They said, this is banana. Smell the banana. So you smell the banana. Then they give you the four unmarked samples of banana, grape, orange, and raspberry and say, okay, which one of these is banana? Smell them. So, okay, pretty straightforward. Then they do it the other way. They say, smell the banana. And here are four samples. You need to not smell them, but one at a time swallow them and breathe out which one's banana. So that's an orthonasal sample and a retronasal test. Mm-hmm. Then they went the next way around, which was, okay, here's a sample that you're going to swallow and breathe out to get the sensation. And now we want you to orthonasally smell each of these. So you're doing that the other way around.
You're doing it backwards and trying to identify the sample, the unknown sample, by testing retronasally.
Yep. And then, of course, you do the retro version, which is for both. You swallow and breathe out. And so that's one thing with banana versus grape versus strawberry. But think about that for four different kinds of strawberry, or for four flavors that you – or four aromas, rather, that you really aren't familiar with, at least by name, not familiar with. I'd be laughing about that one all day now. So a very interesting test. And what they found, you know, as expected, is that it's hard to identify, you know, to smell something one way and then try and identify it when it comes back in the other direction on you. It's very different. And of course, understanding that all the things we just talked about, there are digestive and temperature issues that go on during that process of getting it to your retronasal entryway, so to speak, that change everything. So for the banana, grape, and all that, you know, they're familiar. People know what they are. It's not as – there was no real difference. For the other ones, though, yeah, it can be very difficult to understand. One of the things I loved about this study, and you know, didn't we just talk about the scientific method for like two straight months?
We did, yes, exactly.
It feels like it. They really went through the paces of being careful here. And one of the things they did was they – you know, if you were drinking something to test it, it was in a black cup. If you were sniffing it, it was in a foil-covered tube. They got the visual stimulus out of the way. Because you see something yellow, and you're going, that's the banana. Come on. I know that's the banana. Even if it's not the banana, right. You're thinking it's the banana.
Yeah, isolating variables is part of the experimental design.
Yeah, they did a very nice job with that. But that's, you know, in a nutshell, as James said, well worth reading this. It's only, you know, like I said, 7 pages minus some detailed notes in the back, pretty pictures. It's just validation of what you would expect, which is that, yes, smelling things differently gives you a different result. And sometimes you can't match. You can't match the two. Really, really well-written article. And of all the scientific articles that we've gone through, I thought this one was very digestible. I did actually mean that it was not difficult at all to understand and to read, but, you know.
That was bad.
I wasn't even going there when I said it. I really did mean to say that it is not a difficult one to absorb and to follow, because some of these things are just impermeable. They really can be. But this was not like that.
No, yes, this is a good paper. Mm-hmm. Well designed experiment, well executed, and well described. I know we're running a little long here, but the ultimate thing I took out of this was validation that if you can't already clearly identify an aroma, it's a mixture of compounds. Strawberry is a mixture of compounds, but cumulatively, in your brain says strawberry because you've made that identification. But now you've got 4 different types of strawberry, and you're like, now tell the difference. Now you're getting into the nitty gritty. Now you're getting more into that taster side of things, as opposed to saying, you know, a grape and a banana are 2 different things. Yeah, they are, Batman. They're 2 different things, and you can tell them apart because you have names for them. But as soon as you give you 2 samples that are different from different fruits, let's say, or different sources, and you don't have names for them, now you have to describe them in a different way. They have no identity in your brain. They're just the sum of their components. Now you get to describing their components as a way to differentiate between them. And that's where people get stuck in the swamp of aroma, is that there are so many to choose from and to pick from. How do you describe them? Yeah.
And so few words. We don't have the right words.